Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
He wore a badge, pledging to protect and serve. A Martin County, Florida sheriff's deputy who used his power to abduct, torture, and kill young women and girls in the early 1970s. He was convicted of 2 murders, but he is widely suspected in the deaths of over 30 victims. Today, we will discuss the victims, the killer's upbringing, his crimes, the investigation, and the strange aftermath. This is the story of one of the most heinous serial killers in modern history. Today's perplexing episode is all about Gerard John Schaefer. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Kadra. If you're new to the show, hello and welcome. I tell tales every single week that have perplexed me, so if you love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more, don't worry, you're in the right place. And if you end up enjoying today's true crime deep dive all about Gerard John Schaefer, I'd love if you continue to follow along. If you are a returning listener or viewer, hello, my friends, welcome back. I'm happy you're here today. Thank you, Anthony, for sending an email requesting I talk about Gerard John Schaefer. I had not heard of him before. After finishing all this research, I wish I hadn't, but it's an important story and a very crazy one. So, big trigger warning for today's episode. This is going to be very disturbing. There's also tons and tons of sources that I used for this episode. So, all of those will be down in the show notes if you are interested. Without further ado, let's get into today's episode about serial killer Gerard John Schaefer. So it's the middle of summer in Florida in 1972. 2 teenagers who had been hitchhiking have just escaped near death. Pamela Wells and Nancy Trotter have just wriggled out of their ligatures. They're running and screaming, begging for someone to hear them and help them. The girls had been tied to trees, assaulted, tortured, and they were next up for murder. The killer had left and planned to come back soon. They took their chance and escaped. The man responsible would later be identified as Deputy Gerard John Schaefer, also known at the time as the Butcher of Blind Creek. This was not the first time Schaefer had harmed women, and it unfortunately would not be the last. Born in Neenah, Wisconsin on March 25, 1946, Schaefer was the eldest of 3 children. His parents were Gerard Schaefer, Sr. and Doris. They moved all over because of Gerard Sr.'s job as a traveling salesman for a paper manufacturer, going from Wisconsin to Tennessee to Atlanta, then finally they settled in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Schaefer seemed like a typical, well-behaved young boy. He was a model student. He grew up going to Catholic school. He was active. He loved playing sports. He would hunt and fish. But he would later describe his childhood home as being tumultuous and unstable. He also said his parents were strict and very religious. He, at this time, says he had a very black and white view of what was right and wrong. But all of that would obviously later change. Schaefer's dad was often gone for work and an emotionally distant alcoholic. Schaefer claimed his parents were never happy with him and that he constantly felt inferior. Schaefer seemed to develop an inferiority complex, constantly feeling the need to be better. He claimed his parents wished he had been born a girl, which is interesting because he would later develop a very strong hatred for women. From an early age, it became apparent Schaefer had an obsession with violence and control. He was known to kill small animals from a young age in very cruel and tortuous ways. He liked hunting, sure, but there's no reason to be killing turtles, for example, and Schaefer would do things like this. He was also known to make inappropriate sexual and violent jokes to his peers. He seemed popular amongst male peers, but females often found him to be creepy. Men that are listening to this, something to please keep in mind. Just because you find a guy normal and cool doesn't mean that they are to women. If you have a woman in your life who tells you, hey, this guy is creepy, take it seriously, you know? It's similar in true crime cases when a man goes to like an all-male prison and they're a quote-unquote model prisoner and they get early release. Like, of course they behaved in prison. They weren't around women. Schaefer became known around the town as a peeping Tom, looking into young ladies' windows. Schaefer claimed the women who did this were quote-unquote slutty and intentionally seeking male attention. He began to display a strong hatred and objectification of women. Schaefer publicly categorized women into two groups, virgins and whores. These behaviors soon escalated, and he started entering these ladies' homes, stealing their belongings. He even stole their underwear. Schaefer also got into masochism. He enjoyed tying himself to trees. It would arouse him. This is something that will come up in his crimes later. He also had a fascination with death and enjoyed hurting himself. Schaefer then allegedly started to kill larger animals. There were some cattle in the town he had lived in being killed, mutilated, and sodomized. The documentary that I watched where they mention this, they don't clearly say, hey, this was Schaefer. He was never convicted of that crime, so it's alleged. But if he did do this, it's obviously very disturbing and paints a much bigger picture into how deeply disturbed Schaefer was. As he grew older, Schaefer started dating. When he was a teenager, he dated a girl for 1 year named Sandra London. This name will also come up later. Schaefer told Sandra about some concerning sexual fantasies that he had. Keep in mind, he's a teenager at this point. Schaefer told Sandra London he enjoyed peeping into girls' windows and that he wanted to kill women. Next, Schaefer dated a girl named Cindy. They dated for a couple years, and according to Schaefer, who knows how much of this is true, but he says they got into role play and that it was consensual. There's other sources that say Schaefer would violently rape Cindy. He would sneak up behind her, he would rip her clothing off. He also developed paraphilia, an arousal and fascination with women dying. When later describing role play fantasies in prison, Schaefer claimed he only did things like this because his girlfriends wanted him to. He claimed it wasn't his thing and that he was a romantic type. He liked moonlit walks and flowers. I'm not kidding. He literally said this in an interview. He also claimed when his relationships ended that they were completely amicable. Schaefer also lied constantly. We've talked about this with other serial killers I've covered. Pathological lying is a common trait with these people because it's common with people who have personality disorders. He seemed to lie to inflate himself. Remember, he had an inferiority complex growing up. He would tell these fantastical stories about these places he had traveled to, all these crazy things that had happened to him when he hadn't really gone anywhere. Now, Schaefer was an adult. He attended Florida Atlantic University and he met a fellow student named Martha Fogg. Him and Martha got married. This was his first marriage. He would have several more. The marriage only lasted 1 year because Schaefer was obviously deeply disturbed. He was displaying a lot of erratic behavior, and Martha found a suicide note from him. Schaefer was also waving firearms around. It just was not a safe environment for Martha to be in. Schaefer ended up going to see a psychiatrist after Martha took the suicide note to the school, and they diagnosed Schaefer at this time with depression. Later on, Gerald Schaefer would be diagnosed in his older years as a paranoid schizophrenic, though this diagnosis is controversial and it has been questioned by experts. Martha filed later for divorce on the grounds of experiencing extreme cruelty. I would not be surprised if she was being abused. Schaefer would later say that the sex from Martha wasn't good enough for him. She wasn't fulfilling him. Schaefer's highly concerning and erratic behavior continued to go unchecked, so it only escalated. He also was struggling with work. He tried to go to seminary school to get into the priesthood, but he got rejected. They said he didn't have enough faith. He then left the Catholic Church altogether, and he wanted to become a teacher. So he got a bachelor's degree in education at Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton. As horrifying as it is to think about, John Schaefer briefly worked in education. He worked with students in high schools in Broward County. Can you imagine finding out that this guy was your child's teacher? He wanted to be around kids. It seems like that's because kids are easier to manipulate, control, but Schaefer quickly got fired for inappropriate behavior. He then got a job as a security guard, which, not so fun fact, is the number one job for serial killers, apparently. That was in another source that I came across. So by 1971, Schaefer had entered his next career, working as a cop, and he would use this job to manipulate and kill countless victims. It didn't take long for the complaints to start stacking up against Schaefer. He was known to be controlling on patrols and misuse his authority. He would pull women over and threaten to arrest them or ticket them unless they provided him with sexual favors. Disgusting. But he was able to blend in enough into society and socially because Schaefer got remarried. So this second marriage was with a woman named Teresa Dean. Schaefer would often brag to his coworkers about how he would come home to his wife, throw her over the couch, and sodomize her. Can you imagine these things coming out of anyone's mouth, let alone a coworker? Like, this man is so sick. It just makes me so angry. It's disgusting. Around this time, one too many complaints had stacked against Schaefer, and he was put on notice by the police chief. According to some sources, the chief was considering giving Schaefer another chance, though. Why? No fucking idea. But while Schaefer was on this leave, he applied to another police department. And back then, records didn't travel with you. During this interview with the other police department, Schaefer badmouthed his chief. The chief found out because obviously this other chief or whoever he interviewed with probably called him. And so then the chief formally let him go. So assaulting women and talking about your wife getting sodomized at work, apparently that's not a reason for the chief to fire you. But if you badmouth the chief, that's a reason. That's just insane. So Schaefer got his next deputy job at Martin County Police Department. And you might be wondering how he got another job with all of these complaints. But again, the records didn't follow you. And additionally, Martin County was in like this desperate need. They needed more cops. They weren't really getting a lot of applicants. So Martin County had a relatively low crime rate at the time. It was known to be very tranquil and beautiful. And basically the way Schaefer got the job is he forged a letter of recommendation saying that he helped solve a major drug bust. So he made himself look good to Martin PD. Martin PD did not verify the claims in this letter, and Schaefer came across as intelligent and respectable. Schaefer also knew the Martin County area very well. He was local. He had experience. So 26-year-old Schaefer gets this job for Martin County PD, and he lasted for 1 month. So let's get into the crimes that Schaefer committed.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
During his 1 month as deputy, on July 21st, 1972, Schaefer would pull over two young girls. They had been walking around trying to hitchhike to the beach, and this was 17-year-old Nancy Ellen Trotter and 18-year-old Paula Sue Wells. So he pulls over to the side of the road. He's like, hey, where are you going? What are you doing? They're trying to get a ride to the beach. So good old nice police officer is like, hey, I can take you there. I can help you, blah, blah, blah. So 17-year-old, 18-year-old, like these kids don't know. And so they get in. They trust this police officer. He picked them up while he was on duty. Like, of course you're gonna trust this person, especially when you're so young. So when the girls got in his car, Schaefer was polite. He came across as a fatherly figure, saying they shouldn't hitchhike, that it was dangerous, there are crazy people out there, blah, blah, blah. But then he took the girls home and he told them that he would pick them up the next day and take them to Jensen Beach. I'm wondering why he dropped them off and came back the next day, because he did come back. It's just very odd. So the next day, he picks them up from, I believe, Nancy's house. But this time, he's not in his squad car. He's not in his uniform. He's in his personal vehicle and street clothes. And I would imagine this probably unsettled the girls. But he told them, "Don't worry, I'm undercover. I'm working. I just need to be like this for the day." And that seemed to ease their worries. But instead of taking the girls to Jensen Beach, he took them to an isolated swampy area of Hutchinson Island, saying he wanted to show them something. Schaefer started to act very strange. He wasn't using his nice police officer fatherly demeanor anymore. He was harassing the girls about the dangers of hitchhiking and how stupid they were for getting in a car with a random man. He also asked the girls if they wanted to be sold into white slavery. He then stopped the car, handcuffed the girls, and gagged them with rags. This area was very narrow, it was heavily wooded, and it was completely isolated by the Indian River waterway. He told the girls that they were going to be raped and murdered. He tied the girls to large cypress trees with thick ropes. He made the girls balance on slippery roots. He created nooses and tied the girls in such a way that if they slipped, they would choke to death. They would asphyxiate. He assaulted them both while they were tied up like this. Schaefer then looked at his watch, said he had to go. He went back to work, and he said he'd be back later to finish the job. This is extremely escalated. We'll get there. But at this time, Schaefer would soon get caught for this crime, and police didn't know of anything else. He had a clean record. It's incredibly scary how undetected these people can go and for so long, especially back during this time period. So Schaefer's like, "I'll be back later to finish the job." He also told the girls that one of them would die, and they needed to decide which one. This is a deeply disturbed individual. Nancy and Paula luckily were able to wriggle free when Schaefer left. They used their teeth on the rope knots and they quickly escaped. So when Schaefer comes back to quote unquote finish the job and sees that they're not there, he panics. Oh no, I messed up. And he's trying to think of how to get out of this because he knows that they've seen his face, they know he works for the police, and obviously they're going to go straight to the police to report this. So he calls his police chief in a panic, Robert Crowder. And Schaefer made one of the most ridiculous claims I have ever heard. He just wanted to scare the girls into never hitchhiking again. This was all a joke that went too far. Robert Crowder and Lieutenant Melvin Walden raced to the area where the girls had been, trying to find them and help them. So they find Nancy and Paula. They're still mouths gagged, hands behind their back, their clothing's torn up. They're absolutely hysterical. And luckily, the girls did not have any significant physical injuries. Schaefer lost his job and was charged with kidnapping, but then his sentence was reduced to aggravated assault and false imprisonment. I don't know why the sentence was reduced. The only thing I can think is privilege of him being a cop, a white male, a clean record, but this would prove to be fatal. The judge later called Schaefer an astronomical jackass, but nevertheless, his sentence was reduced. He also got a deal. They cut this man a deal, and he was only given 6 months in jail. He had nooses around these girls' necks. He assault, like, I can't even. Additionally, the courts were sure to wait until after the holidays to put Schaefer in prison because he said he did not want to miss Christmas with his family. And he also needed some extra time to relocate his wife to his mother's home in Fort Lauderdale. And the courts were like, No problem. You don't have to go to jail right away. You can wait. So 6 months goes by before John Schaefer goes to prison. Another decision that would prove to be fatal. In late September 1972, just 2 months after his last attack, Schaefer posted his $15,000 bail, returned home, and days after his release, he attacked again. He took 17-year-old Susan Place and 16-year-old Georgia Jessup after meeting them at an education center. They had been participating in a general education development course. Schaefer went under a false name, telling the girls his name was Jerry Shepherd. Both of the girls had recently dropped out of high school. They allegedly struck up a conversation with Schaefer, and then one of the girls invited Schaefer over to Susan's house in Fort Lauderdale. He showed up soon after this meetup. He gets to Susan's house while her parents are there. This is how bold this guy is. He's doing all of this in front of one of the future victim's parents. He assures Susan's mother, looks her in the face. Her name was Lucille. He goes, "Lucille, don't worry. My intentions are noble. I'm just going to keep the girls safe. We're just going out for a little hangout. You have nothing to worry about." Lucille had this gut feeling, and in the back of her mind, she's like, "I don't know. He seems okay, but I don't know." So she wrote down his license plate, just in case, and he left with the girls. When the girls didn't return home, Lucille called the police and gave them Schaefer's physical description along with his license plate number. The officer who took the call wrote down the license plate number wrong. He got like one of the letters wrong or something. So nothing came of Lucille's report. Susan and Georgia's mothers were on their own to search for their daughters. They had to investigate themselves. They searched the girls' rooms, and they ended up finding a letter that Georgia had written to this Jerry Shepherd, which makes me wonder how long they were corresponding. I couldn't really get a clear timeline on that. But this letter had a return to sender with an address. So the moms go to this address, and this ended up being Gerard John Schaefer's old house. So they arrive to the house, and they speak to the new owner. This is how they found out Schaefer no longer lived at this residence, because he had attacked two girls recently on Hutchinson Island. Meanwhile, it's January 1973. It's time for the kidnapping trial for Nancy Trotter and Paula Wells. The trial began, and the parents of Georgia Jessup and Susan Place hear about this in the media, and they start to notice that there's a lot of similarities between these cases and their daughters' cases. And so this makes them think more and more that their girls were harmed in a horrific way and that they're not going to be able to find them. I can't imagine finding out news like this way and feeling so helpless. The parents also found out where Schaefer was serving his 6-month sentence, and they also found his most recent residence. So they drove to this house. They find the same car in the driveway that he used to kidnap their daughters, the same license plate and everything, and they called the police once again. While the mothers were there, Lucille talked to Schaefer's wife, Teresa. Teresa invites her inside. While they're chatting, Mrs. Place spotted her daughter's purse just sitting in the Schaefer's home. Teresa explained Schaefer had given Teresa the purse as a present. A few more months went by, and on April 1st, 1973, some men who had been collecting cans out on Hutchinson Island came across the skeletal remains of two young girls who would later be identified through dental records as Georgia Jessup and Susan Place. The remains and clothing were scattered around a hole dug amongst the trees. Both of their teeth had been removed. The tops of their skulls were missing and never found. The girls had been severely mutilated. Their bones showed signs of knife cuts. Georgia's spine had been severed. She had been cut in half at the waist. Both Georgia and Susan were missing an arm. They were both decapitated post-mortem. Their jaws had numerous fractures. Susan also had a gunshot wound to her jaw. Their wrists still had remnants of restraints on them. The men who made this discovery were so horrified it made them physically ill. This was easily the worst thing that they had ever seen. Susan and Georgia's remains were also found just 6 miles from the location of Nancy Trotter and Paula Wells' attacks. Near the bodies, there were also initials carved into one of the trees, G.J., Georgia Jessup. These were carved into the tree along with marks on the tree that appeared to be from thick ropes. This was the worst crime that police had ever seen in the county. Given the similarities between the cases, the discovery of Georgia and Susan's remains led police to Schaefer. They then got search warrants for multiple dwellings that he had access to. When they searched Schaefer's mother's house, they found items he had taken from many, many prior victims, which makes sense because these crimes are insanely brutal. They're so escalated. This is clearly not where he started. So now police had to work backwards and figure out who all of these belongings belonged to, what happened to these women, when. There were so many things they had to figure out. 7 pieces of jewelry were found in this trinket box that he had been saving. There were ID cards, all kinds of things. Schaefer had been taking trophies from his victims and using these things to help himself get off over and over again. They also found 37 Polaroid photographs depicting women being hung and mutilated. These seemed to be other victims, but the photographs were too blurry to make a clear identification. The jewelry ended up linking to 7 missing girls. These reports had been filed over the last 4 years. After sharing this information with other jurisdictions, they started to make connections. This quickly added up to at least 32 potential victims. One of the trophies found was a gold locket later linked to Lee Hanlein Bonadies, who had gone missing in September 1969. Her name was engraved in the necklace that Schaefer had in his possession. She was Schaefer's neighbor when they were teenagers, and Schaefer was known to peep in her window. Her remains were found in the subdivision of Boca del Mar, which was under construction at the time, in Boca Raton, Florida, in January 1978. Lee's skull was riddled with bullet holes, and she was positively identified much later in 2004. 2 gold-filled teeth and a shamrock pin were also found in Schaefer's possession, and these were positively identified by the family of 22-year-old Carmen Marie Candy Halleck from Florida. Candy disappeared in December 1969. She called her sister-in-law and told her that she had an appointment with a male teacher from the local junior college that evening. Candy said this teacher also did undercover work for the government and that the meeting revolved around a possible job opportunity for her. This would include international travel, a high salary. Candy was super ecstatic, and she wanted to make a good impression. She purchased a pair of black patent leather pumps and told her sister-in-law she planned to wear the shoes that evening, along with a black cocktail dress. She was never seen again. Candy's sister-in-law became concerned when she was unable to contact Candy by Christmas Day, 1969. She arrived at Candy's apartment to check on her. Candy's car keys, driver's license, and vehicle registration were missing. But Candy's bathtub was full, and her dog had not been fed. To this day, the remains of Carmen Marie Candy Halleck have never been located. 7 years after the fact, Schaefer was also linked to the disappearance of 21-year-old Nancy Leichner and 20-year-old Pamela Ann Nader. This is something that Schaefer would commonly do. He would take 2 girls at a time. They called them doubles. He kidnapped 2 girls. They got away. He kills Georgia and Susan. And he had been doing this at least since the 60s. So the same situation for Nancy Leichner and Pamela Ann Nader. Nancy and Pamela were Pinellas County residents, and they vanished on October 2nd, 1966, while they were on a picnic in Ocala National Forest. The deeper the investigators delved, the further back Schaefer's crimes seemed to go. Nancy and Pamela were last seen going into the woods together along one of the nature trails. They left their purses, clothing, shoes, Nancy's eyeglasses, and other personal belongings behind on a picnic table. An extensive search was organized when they did not return, covering 15 square miles, but there was not a single trace of Nancy or Pamela. Their case remains unsolved to this day. Both women are still considered missing. Nancy was last seen wearing a 2-piece bathing suit. The bottom part was blue, and the top part had blue and red stripes. Pamela was last seen wearing a blue and white two-piece bathing suit and a blue and white pinstriped boys Gant or Hugger short-sleeved shirt. Another alleged victim of Schaefer was 13-year-old Deborah Sue Lowe. She was last seen walking to Rickards Middle School in the vicinity of 8th Street and Sunrise Boulevard in Pompano Beach, Florida, between 7:30 and 8 a.m. on February 29, 1972. It was about a mile-long trip between her home and the school. Deborah never arrived at school. Her school books were later found in the garbage a block from her home. Authorities initially believed Deborah had run away. Deborah's family never believed this. She had no prior history of running away. It seems like there really wasn't any investigation for Deborah until it was way too late. Deborah was last seen wearing a tan poncho, a yellow blouse, black slacks with vertical rose-colored stripes, and a ring with an aquamarine stone. The ring is shaped like a flower with 8 off-white petals with gold wire around them, a blue dot in the center, and a gold band. Deborah's father died of a heart attack 4 years after her disappearance, and her mother died in 1995. But the rest of the family continues to search for her. Her case remains unsolved. Her remains have never been found. A license belonging to 19-year-old Barbara Ann Wilcox and a passport, diary, and a book of poems belonging to 19-year-old Colette Marie Goodenough were found in Schaefer's possession. Barbara and Colette were both reported missing on January 15, 1973. They had been hitchhiking from Biloxi, Mississippi to Florida. Their bodies were found 4 years later at Port St. Lucie, January 1977. Other items of significance found in Schaefer's mother's home included teeth and bone fragments, believed to belong to 8 distinct female victims.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Police also found a diary of Schaefer's with handwritten manuscripts describing incredibly horrific acts of violence in disturbing detail. He wrote of women being bound, typically hung, being killed in horrific ways. Then he described the sexual fantasies that he would live out with their corpses. Because of this, many people believe Schaefer was also a necrophiliac. This is one of those cases where you really can't think that it could get any worse, and it just keeps getting worse. So let's talk about the trial for a little bit. In October 1973, Schaefer was convicted. This is for the trial of Georgia Jessup and Susan Place, the victims that were taken in 1972. He was convicted of first-degree murder for Georgia and Susan. The jury was unanimous. There's footage of Schaefer throughout this trial, smirking and smiling. Nancy Trotter and Paula Wells, the girls who escaped Schaefer, also testified. They did like a video reenactment. I don't know if they had to like testify in person, but I know that they did a video reenactment of what he had done to them. And this really helped with getting a conviction. So it's incredibly brave and powerful that they were able to do that. So Schaefer was sentenced at this time to 2 consecutive life terms, 40 years. The death penalty was not available in Florida at this time. Schaefer was in jail with other prolific serial killers like Ted Bundy, Otis Toole, Danny Rawlings. This was quite a time in America. Authorities would also compare Schaefer at one point to Ted Bundy, saying that he made Ted Bundy look like, quote, a Boy Scout. As for Schaefer's time in prison, he was sent to Rayford Prison and he maintained prolific correspondence with the media, something that always upsets me in cases like this. Why are we giving these people a platform? Like, they should not be able to have a platform and talk about these things. You know, give a platform to the victims' families, the loved ones. He was interviewed all throughout the 80s, and during this time, he tried to paint himself as innocent. When this didn't work, he decided that he needed notoriety. And so what did he do? He published a book called Killer Fiction, and this was written with the help, I cannot make this up, of his ex-girlfriend from high school. Sandra London, that teenager he dated, the very first girlfriend that we talked about. Sandra London found out about Schaefer's crimes, I'm assuming in the media. She goes to the prison, sits down, and is like, I'll help you write a book. And if anybody has any ounce of decency here, let me be very clear. Sandra London, piece of shit. Horrible person, in my opinion. Okay? And the reason that I'm saying this is because she also was later engaged to a convicted serial killer named Danny Rowling. So this is a perfect example of hybristophilia or prison groupies being in love with someone in prison. It is a very disturbing condition. I don't even know what to call it, but I did like a whole episode about hybristophilia on Patreon, so I'm not going to get super deep into that. But I don't feel bad about speculating if she had anything going on with Schaefer, because Sandra London is a horrible person, in my opinion. She also wrote a book about Danny Rowling. She profited off of these sick crimes as well. Keep that in mind. She wrote two books. During this time, Schaefer also messed up. He wrote a letter to Sandra in 1989 where he boasted, remember, I told you this keeps getting worse. He boasted about killing and cannibalizing two young girls. Throughout this entire time, Schaefer had never named any more names in prison. Police were incredibly frustrated with him. He wouldn't give them any other names, any other locations. They couldn't get this guy on anything else. And what's also so deeply scary about him is he knew how to hide evidence. He knew how to get away with things and be undetected. So who were these two young girls? On December 29th, 1969, Wendy Brown Stevenson and her friend Peggy Ron vanished from Pompano Beach, Florida. Wendy was 8 years old and Peggy was 9 years old. The two girls vanished after they were last seen walking toward the beach parking lot to buy ice cream. They were seen in the company of a man in his 20s, standing 6 feet tall and around 200 pounds. After police found this confession letter, I don't know if Sandra gave it to them or what, but Schaefer was later accused of the crime, of the murders of Wendy and Peggy, obviously. But they've never found any evidence, like no remains, nothing. The only thing that they have is one of the girls' brooches was found in Schaefer's possession. So they have that, and they have his confession to Sandra. I feel like that's pretty strong. Because Wendy and Peggy's remains have never been found, you can find their information on the Charlie Project. That's where I'm describing a lot of like what they were last wearing, their physical descriptions. So Wendy had a small mole at the center of her neck and an appendectomy scar. She was last seen wearing a blue and white checkered swimsuit. Peggy had a small scar under her right eye and a birthmark on her right knee. She was last seen wearing a pink baby doll swimsuit with fringe. Throughout Schaefer's conversations with the media, he also claimed that Ted Bundy's murders were a tribute to his, and that Bundy wanted to be the best. That's why he killed 36, because Schaefer had allegedly killed 34. He says this in interviews. So you get all these different sources about how many victims Schaefer had, according to him in this interview, 34. But he's only been convicted for the murder of two. Schaefer did attempt to appeal his conviction, but he was unsuccessful. Cold case teams had connected Schaefer to many more victims and had planned to charge him for further murders. Just before Schaefer was about to be interviewed in prison by Broward County homicide detectives regarding three other missing women, Gerard John Schaefer was murdered in his prison cell. After spending just over a decade in prison, on December 3rd, 1995, Schaefer was found dead in his Florida prison cell. The person responsible was inmate Vincent Rivera, who was later convicted for the murder. Schaefer was known to be strongly disliked in prison, which this is information that shocks no one. He was egotistical and annoying, and Vincent had had enough. Schaefer was stabbed 47 times. His eyes were gouged out and his throat was slit from ear to ear. Others say Schaefer may have been killed because he had become a police informant. Some people see this end to Gerard John Schaefer to the sick monster as justice, him getting what he deserved. Others see it as incredibly heartbreaking because this left dozens of families and loved ones with no answers and closure in regards to what happened to their loved ones. Decades later, in 2022, it seems another victim has been linked to Schaefer, 15-year-old Susan Poole. Her disappearance closely mirrors the details of Candy Hollick, which, if you guys remember, I talked about her earlier in the episode. She had disappeared a few years prior to Susan Poole, also right around Christmas time. So Susan Poole also disappeared around Christmas. Susan enjoyed rock and roll. She had a lot of friends. She was bubbly. She was described as a hippie by her sister, Patty. She had recently dropped out of school, and she had been splitting time living with her family in their trailer and staying with a friend in a nearby apartment called Wilton Manors. She then seemingly vanished out of nowhere. Her clothes and her pocketbook were still at her friend's apartment. Her family reported her missing just before Christmas, December 22, 1972. This was also the same area where 14-year-old high school students Elsie Farmer and Mary Alice Briscolina had disappeared on October 23rd. It's believed Elsie Farmer and Mary Alice Briscolina had been hitchhiking their way out of South Florida, and Schaefer picked them up on Commercial Boulevard. Elsie lived in the same trailer park as Susan. They all disappeared around the same time. Elsie and Mary's bodies were found at a construction site in Plantation on January 17, 1973, 8 days after Schaefer went to prison. Susan Poole was missing for 2 years, and her case quickly went cold. Her remains were found tied with wire to the mangroves in Palm Beach County, Florida, in 1974. This is an area known as Burnt Bridges on A1A at MacArthur Beach State Park. There were only skeletal remains, and her clothing was mostly deteriorated. Susan was described as being a white female between the ages of 14 and 25. At this time, she became known as the Singer Island Jane Doe. She was exhumed in April 2014 and in 2015. A DNA profile was developed, but there was no match at this time in CODIS. In 2019, a new facial reconstruction was prepared, but her image was not recognized by anyone. She wasn't identified until nearly 50 years later using advanced DNA matching technology. Shortly after Susan Poole went missing, December 22, 1972, Schaefer kidnapped 22-year-old Belinda Garcia Hutchins on January 5th. She was a cocktail waitress. Her address book was later found in Schaefer's possession, containing the name, address, and phone number of Belinda's husband. No other trace of Belinda was ever found, and no charges were ever filed. Countless victims, countless stories. And anytime a serial killer is discussed, it's easy to get caught up in the killer. People get obsessed with their psyche, trying to figure out why, how could they have done something like this? Searching for logic, in my opinion, where there is none. So I just want to remind everyone of who really matters, the victims. I tried to find everything that I could about these victims, but it was very difficult to find anything about them in the sources that I combed through for weeks. And there are still so many victims, women and girls, who haven't been identified, that are still missing. The remains have never been found. The families never got full answers. There wasn't much about these women and young girls out there. And I can't even begin to imagine how their loved ones feel. It's also important to point out that the police had multiple opportunities to stop Schaefer sooner. The justice system failed these families multiple times, but especially in the legal charges for the kidnapping and sexual assaults of Pamela Wells and Nancy Trotter. Schaefer has been connected to at least 28 other victims that have been murdered or listed as missing, and Schaefer alluded to 34 while he was still alive. He continued to be elusive with names and details. So what happened to these women and girls, to a certain extent, remains a mystery. It's also highly possible that there are more victims the police never connected. Schaefer claimed at one time that he took girls from all over the United States. According to some sources I read, I was kind of confused by this because he seemed elusive in prison and like wouldn't name other names. But then there's other people that are like, yeah, he said he took people from all over the U.S., which would not surprise me. So it does beg the question, how many more unsolved cases are out there? because of Deputy Gerard John Schaefer. And that, everybody, is today's perplexing episode about the serial killer Gerard John Schaefer and his many victims. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed the way the story was told, I would love if you let me know. Interact wherever you're listening or watching. It really, really helps. And if you want to support the show further, if you want early ad-free episodes and tons of bonus content, that is at The Perplexed Society. That's patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. Thank you again to Anthony for requesting this and sending an email. You guys can always send topic requests. Also, listener stories, please. I cannot tell you the last time I got a listener story, and it makes me sad. I want to hear y'all's true crime experiences, your paranormal experiences, anything mysterious. Please send me your stories on the website, perplexitymysterypodcast.com, or you can also send them to me in a DM. You can email them to me. I don't care, but I want your stories so that I can compile them and do a special episode. Please and thank you. You all are amazing. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, and I will talk to you next week. Bye.
Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast, is hosted, written, and produced by me, Kadra Brannon. This show is proud to be a part of the Black Cat Network. Assistant editor is Charlie Leopold. Theme song by Patrick Thompson. All music used in this episode is from Pixabay. If you like the show, be sure to share it with others and leave a 5-star rating and review. Contact, support, and merch links can be found in the episode description. To unlock early ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content, join the Perplexed Society at patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. Listener stories, topic requests, and business inquiries can be submitted to perplexitymysterypodcast.com or emailed to perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. Until next week, stay curious.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At ChumbaCasino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.